Did you set him straight?
I was unable to do so.
Unsuccessful. You're trying.
Thank you, board members. We'll resume our meeting. I think there was some effort in over lunchtime put into resolve the location, at least the location of where the proposed amendment should be. Could you give us an update, please, Mark, where we are?
I think we need to bring it up. So, staff during the break feels that we could make a new section 10, which states the department shall require the use of standardized forms for landowners requesting extensions under section 8 and for annual reporting under section 9 of this section. So that's taking into account subsection 8 is for landowners that are requesting an extension. And 9 is for all landowners with an approved RMAP, and that's the annual reporting of work accomplished and work that they're going to do.
So I assume this was from the cluster of people over there. I assume this was a collaborative effort.
There was consultation. Yes.
Good. So, Norm.
Commissioner, I will move that the new language of Section 10 is proposed to be added to the draft rule language that we are considering.
Second.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion properly supported to add Section 10 as shown on the screen there, Norm?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Discussion on the motion.
Tom, do you want to go first?
Yes, Tom.
Lisa, I just have a question on whether it should state under subsection 8 and subsection 9.
Versus section?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Can you add that to the subsection? I didn't see a shaking of the head over there. Did that mean no? Can we do it?
Yes.
Okay. Anna, you had another question?
Yeah, just wondering if it would be possible to add, as specified in the board manual, after the standardized form reference in there. That was part of Dave's original language and what we were talking about before lunch, about just making sure that everything is linked and having that specificity of this is where the
Would you be more specific,
sure.
Anna, about your request?
So the department shall require the use of standardized forms as specified in the board manual for landowners requesting. So just to add that there.
Is it to be specified?
Well,
either way
is good. Either way is okay.
Simple.
To be clear, as it stands right now, the forms are referenced to the board manual. They are not part of the board manual. They are certainly discussed, and there's a link in the discussion to each form. Mark, is that correct in how we set it up?
That's correct.
So would it be more appropriate then to say referenced in the board manual as rather than specified?
That's
okay,
fine.
Okay, let's put referenced in there. And that's sort of been the historical process.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
We do reference forms in the rules, not always in the board manual, but I don't think it's a problem.
Okay. Okay, so we have another amendment to the proposed rule. It's there on the board for everybody's reference. And I believe, who made the original motion to adopt? Are these subtle changes acceptable?
They're acceptable.
Who seconded it? Sherry, it was acceptable as well?
Well, we need to spell department right.
Well, thank you.
Do we?
You're such a stickler.
I don't approve of that.
Yes, now you.
All right.
How is spelled coordinated?
So we have a motion to amend the rule as shown. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote. All those in...
No, I'm sorry. Dave's original language included explicit reference to, subsection 4 items. And we were having a discussion in our cluster over there about how it was not appropriate to include that in the rule language. And I think that some of us aren't, either clear on why it can't be included and are not necessarily comfortable with the fact that it's not included.
Darren, can you speak to that at all?
I didn't hear the whole comment, but I think I know what it was. So subsection 4, A through E, which was referenced in the earlier handout, those are criteria to consider when a landowner is developing an RMAP and selecting projects and scheduling of those projects. That's what those are. The only item in there that we consistently report on are the barriers, the status of barriers that are identified in the RMAP. The other reportable element that Julie referenced earlier would be miles of road needing improvement and then miles of road brought into standard on an annual basis. That would capture basically B through E, but not at that fine level of detail. It would be a roll-up. So that's what we are proposing to do. We aren't proposing to turn these criteria into reporting elements, either in the form of a revised RMAP. You have to address these, you have to show these criteria as projects, nor in the reporting of work on an annual basis.
So I think the question is, that stuff helps. So the prioritization is about our landowners doing the work first. And if I understand part of the concern, it's that there is inadequate information out there for independent parties to be able to determine if that's actually happening. And so is there, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but is that not the reason why you want to have included in rule language? So you guys could assess when you're out on the ground, or other stakeholders could assess out on the ground whether or not worst first was actually happening. And so especially if there's going to be an extension and some more time, we really want to make sure that worst first is actually being taken care of. So I think then the discussion becomes, are there adequate mechanisms in place that make sure that's going to happen, or do we need to reference that in rule language in order to make everybody comfortable that that's going to happen?
So from an implementation perspective, there are several criteria that are listed in the rule that go into determining worst first. Nonetheless, worst first is somewhat subjective and dynamic. So that's why we have not focused on that level of detail for reporting, because it could change from year to year. While the plan at a higher level has to generally be worst first in even flow, there can be fluctuations year to year. And that's part of the process that's built into the annual review to determine, well, does the original worst first still make sense given what was accomplished or what may have happened in the watershed in the previous year? Do we need to adjust that? That's what the annual work plans are about and the annual reviews that occur, the annual meetings that occur. So that principle is a somewhat dynamic principle through time. And reporting on those, in our perspective, didn't make a lot of sense because of that. And it begs the question as to what scale do you report on these different elements? To me, that opens potentially a Pandora's box about what scale is appropriate for each one of these elements to determine if worst first is actually happening, And then what do you do if Forest First gets adjusted on any given year? To me, it didn't make sense to go there on the annual reporting type of approach.
Norm?
I'd like to point out, too, that the other, many other aspects in our forest practices rules require us to address sediment delivery to waters in an operation, or that could result from an operation. So we're actually required to do that to prevent that delivery to water in our current ongoing operations. It's whether or not it was put first on a priority list, or second, or fifth, or a hundredth, in order to meet the requirements of an ongoing operation, we're required to do that work.
So just to finish up on this discussion, so without these elements A through E and 4, DNR is saying you're still going to be able to assess where all RMAPs are, even the ones that are requesting an extension, and you're planning to do that through the annual reporting standardized format instead?
The annual reporting and the tracking of that information through the information system is certainly a couple of tools that we're going to use to do that. But no amount of paper is a replacement for boots out on the ground, people looking at these things through time. And that's where we put our focus. And I would suggest that that's where the focus needs to be. We want to have a decent level of detail in reporting, and certainly standardized so that everybody's looking at the same information. But in my view, you can't replace any amount of going out on the ground with paper to tell you that things are actually happening as they should be.
So I appreciate that, and I know this has been a sticky subject for all of us, and I just, in the future, I hope we can, this is a very big deal, I think, both for Fish and Wildlife, everyone else at the table, and it would have been really great to have had more dialogue before the meeting and had a chance to look at, since we're going to be relying heavily on these forms, a little bit more time to look at those. So I'm going to be supportive, but it's just, it's been a difficult process. So I'm hoping we can improve that in the future.
Okay. Well, I'm going to continue with the motion and continue with the vote. All those in favor of the amendment to the rule as shown on the board, under section 10, raise your hand. Opposed? Okay, make that 11.
I'm abstaining.
You're abstaining? Okay, so that's 11-1-0. So, motion passes. Tom?
Well, I just want to say for ecology here that I want to see the rule move forward. I know this is a very important thing for landowners, and it's a big benefit to them, and I know they take this very seriously, the RMAP extensions and all the work associated with them. I'm glad to see that. But it is a package, and we've had a lot of dialogue here about what's in the manual, what's in the rule. Both of those things are going out to the public for review. I think that's appropriate. And ultimately, we're going to have to judge whether it's adequate or not after we've heard the public comment and after we see how this shapes up over the next couple months, I think, in terms of these forms and implementation. So I just want to, while saying that I'm in favor of it going forward at this point, I also want to say that we'll be looking very closely at it when it comes around for final approval based on this discussion that we've all had.
So if it's final adoption. That
yes.
would be at the time after public
comment.
Yeah. Yeah. So what Tom is saying is something for everybody to remember, and that is, this is just proposed language going forward. There will be another opportunity to amend it if you think it's important to do so.
And after we've heard public comment on this. Right.
So that brings us back to the original rule that we've been working on.
Tom, you brought up a very important point that I'm not sure if you're in a position you can clarify, but because it is a water quality related issue that it needs Department of Ecology approval as well. And I guess if this doesn't have it at this point from your department, or if it doesn't at some point in the future before we get to adoption, it would be very important for us as a board to know that before we get to that point.
That's my intent.
I think that's why he said what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the difficulty here is Anna pointed out, it's very hard at this moment to be weighing all those things when we're getting forms for the first time that are critical to the total package.
Yeah.
So that's why I just wanted to say. So I appreciate your acknowledgement. Thank you. And we'll do our best to communicate.
That will be very important.
Dave?
And that's how come I'm abstaining, is not prepared to accept that at this point and continue to work through the process and try to get our concerns ironed out.
Okay, good. So that brings us to the underlying motion. Could you put the motion back on the screen, please, that we started with? So, Mr. Advisor, do we need to put any language in there that would say this rule proposal as amended, or can we leave it as it is?
I think it would be best to state as amended.
I'd entertain that motion.
I made the original. I'll make that amendment.
Okay. Support? Okay. Thank you. So we have a proposal to amend the rule, the motion here.
As it is, incorporates Sherry's amendment as well as the one we just...
The two amendments that we processed. Questions about the questions, discussion about the motion. Call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion to adopt, the motion to approve for public review, raise your hand. Okay, opposed? Abstained?
Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we got 11-1-0.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Dave?
The way that reads, WAC 222, the draft rule is what was amended, not the WAC.
Yeah. So it should be draft rule proposal as amended.
As amended.
To amend WAC 222.
I think it's all in this here, but that's...
All right, so let's get it in the right spot.
After proposal.
Oh, if that's the case, I'm a...
But as amended. As amended, and then say to amend. I know there's a lot of amendments. I guess this is an amending process. Yes.
So does that conform, Dave?
Yeah. It's awkward, but better.
So remember, this is just a motion. This is not rule language.
That's right.
We worked on the rule language earlier.
Well said.
Good point. This will disappear.
Okay. All right, I think we're good to go. All right, thank you very much, Board, for that hard work. And we will leave, finally, this brief agenda item and move on to a review of a draft of the board manual, Section 3 guidelines. I'm sure this is very simple.
Okay. We should have put it as part of the motion. Again, this is a draft board manual. It has been prepared to show to the board that we have put into the board manual those parts of the recommendations that should be contained within guidance. The board manual is in your packet, beginning on page B32, and that's what we've done is we've amended section 2.1 and then added additional language also within that. You're all turning pages, so I'll wait. So again, it's on page B3-2 is where it starts. Part 2, 2.1, road maintenance and abandonment plans. We've given you the complete board manual section. Those parts that are draft right now are stated in underlined strikeout. the underlying portions, all the new language, primarily addressing the RMAP review process, then going on to the RMAP extension. If you recall, in a board meeting, I believe it was last August, we showed you the timeline that has now been incorporated within the board manual, so people have a visual of the extension process in addition to the discussion about it. Then talks about the revised RMAP needs, the following information. It then references the forms. It then talks about the prioritization process. And the accomplishment reports. It talks briefly about the RMAP data, the new form that's been created. And then it finishes with the RMAP completion. One of the things that people have noted is that there are today a number of RMAPs that have been completed. The board manual is now creating a process in which landowners will be notified that their RMAP has been accepted as completed, and it also notifies stakeholders as well. And this is very important in the long run.
So, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is being furnished to the board for their review and to take any questions that they might
That's
have?
That's correct. And again, it's so that when people are reviewing the proposed rule language, they can also review the manual to make sure that all of the recommendations contained in the policy proposal are being covered through the rulemaking as a whole. Normally, we do not present a board manual until that point at which we want the board to approve it for inclusion as guidance to new rule. In this case, we're including it as part of the review.
Any questions for staff on this? Sherry?
Mark, on page B3-3, this is just also kind of a little bit nitpicky, but the first bullet under SFL RMAP says no RMAP is required for 80/20 SFL. And I just kind of like for you to go 80 acres of ownership with 20 acre harvest, so it's clear. I'm not, you know, what's 80/20?
Okay.
My prescription is.
Thank you.
And in fact, we could probably expand that they were actually supposed to get a brochure. And I think that was mentioned this morning, that if you're a landowner who owns 80 acres or less and you're harvesting on a parcel that is 20 contiguous acres or less, you do not need to get a checklist RMAP, but instead you need to have a brochure which describes the requirements of the RMAP process.
That'd be a good idea.
And so I got a little sticky note here as a reminder. It's good.
I hope you have a good supply there.
Yeah, we do. For the final manual, when we present this manual for the board's review and approval at the time that the board is considering the adoption of the new rules, we will include the request of the board to address where to place both slash and debris generated during road construction within the 100-year floodplain. As you recall, that was the Ron Malley petition for rulemaking, and the board chose to instead put it into the board manual. That will be included. There's several other small edits that have been requested as BMPs. Those are not included at this time because right now the desire is just to look at the RMAP with the accompanying requirements through the RMAP rulemaking. So in that final manual, you will have the addressing of slash and debris within the 100-year floodplain and several other small edits to the BMPs.
Norm, you had a question, comment?
Yeah, Mark, based on the motion that we just adopted, is this manual still consistent with that motion as far as you know?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Any other comments? All right. Thank you very much, Mark. I think we can move on. So at this time, we'll take public comment on watershed analysis review rulemaking and board manual section 11 standard methodology for conducting watershed analysis. And we have two people who have signed up to make comment. One is, the first one is Miguel Perez Gibson. Miguel, are you here? I see him here. So we'll move on to the second one, Scott Swanson. Good afternoon, Scott.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Swanson. I'm with West Fork Timber Company. I've been in front of you a number of times before on this issue, and all I wanted to say today is I continue to want to express my appreciation for your support for the rule language changes. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. He was here at the beginning of this whole process, and here at the end. Well, that's great.
So one other person was unable to to make comment earlier is Kurt Belhouse, Bill Houston.
Yes.
Kurt?
Right.
Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for flexing your schedule to allow me to comment on the RMAP proposal. Took me a couple tries to get through Smoky Point this morning, so I was just tickled that I could make it. And sorry to have you go back through the issue you thought you just completed, but the good news is I think you'll still be ahead of schedule when I'm done. To introduce myself to those of you who I don't know already, I'm Kurt Belthusen. I'm bringing you comments from the Skagit River System Cooperative, which provides the forest and fish program for the Swinomish and Sauk Suwannal tribes in the Skagit Basin. Our experience with RMAP runs the whole history. We view it as not just part of the Forest and Fish Agreement, it's actually part of our Skagit Chinook Recovery Plan. So it's very important that we were counting on that work being completed by 2016. And unfortunately, regardless of the extension, looking backwards, we've had difficulty seeing this move forward in a steady way. In our basin, our industrial ownerships, several of them have changed hands during the RMAP period, and as a result, there's been delays and reshuffling of priorities that's led to some lack of progress. But yet, we really aren't able to even be assured of where large landowners are because of the tracking system that's been discussed at length this morning. Each year we receive the forms from DNR describing and landowners describing their accomplishments in terms of the number of crossings and the number of miles. Yet they don't always explain where this work was done, so we have no way to really verify that work was done or to know whether it even fell in our basin. So that's been a problem. So I guess with this history, it was difficult for our tribes to come to the decision to support the extension. Obviously, every year that the work is delayed leads to underused habitat and also continuing vulnerability to storm events. And despite the challenges to get behind this, we were able to do so. We want to support the timber managers that we work with on a daily basis, and we want to preserve the TFW spirit as best as we can. So we hope that as part of our work to try to help this go forward, that we will see a gain that we were talking about this morning in terms of a more comprehensive tracking system in terms of progress. So that's really what we hope to get out of this arrangement. We also believe that there is roadwork on the landscape that can be delayed without impacting watershed recovery, and we're more than willing to sit down with our landowners and help them identify those priorities and lower priorities. So that's really my main comment. You know, we rolled up our sleeves and worked with landowners and other folks last summer to get the language worked out and to bring that up in a very timely way. And we just hope that that the board and other folks in this community will work to make sure that the fine print and these the wordings that we've been talking about this morning get resolved, and that there is a chance to take one more look at some of these documents that we're seeing, so that those things are done correctly and we can look back at this process as having been a win-win for different folks involved in the watersheds. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
comments, questions?
Okay. So I think that concludes our public comment on, obviously, on watershed analysis, and opens the opportunity to go on to the next agenda item, which is review rulemaking. Sherry Fox, please.
Go ahead, Sherry.
Too many Sherrys.
He's like, no thanks.
How are you doing, Sherry?
I'm fine. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the board. I'm Sherry Felix with the Board of Practices Division. And it's my pleasure today to ask for your approval, adoption of new watershed analysis rules. The intent of this rulemaking is to ensure that watershed analysis prescriptions continue to address the potential for adverse effects from forest practices to the greatest extent possible over time. The approach used is basically fourfold. Strengthen the requirement for departmental review of approved watershed analysis prescriptions. Implement a process to reanalyze those prescriptions that the department has reviewed and determined need reanalysis. Rescind those prescriptions if they are not reanalyzed, and sunset old and still draft watershed analyses. Implementing these new rules will ensure approved watershed analysis prescriptions continue to be protective enough to warrant exemption from Class 4 special classification. At your last meeting, you directed staff to initiate public review by filing a proposal initiation, CR 102, with the Office of the Code Reviser to conduct hearings on this rulemaking and to conduct SEPA review. All comments the board received were favorable. Today, the proposed language you have before you includes a few changes from the language you reviewed at your last meeting. These changes are clarifications, including better clarifying policy's intentions regarding interim and draft prescriptions and classifying applications during a reanalysis. A couple of specifics. On page 15, lines 8 and 12, this is in the approval of a watershed analysis. New draft watershed analyses, which of course would have a draft or interim prescription, will expire if SEPA is not completed within the 30 days DNR has to approve or disapprove the watershed analysis. The previously proposed language allowed DNR 2 years to complete the SEPA process. So we would have 2 years of draft and interim prescriptions out there that then would apply to application conditioning. And existing interim or draft prescriptions will expire as of July 1 of this year. So this clearly links the SEPA review to the timeline for approval of a watershed analysis required by subsection 1 of watershed analysis approval, and sets the stage for the expiration of all those draft and interim prescriptions out there that are still having to be applied to applications. Another change is, another clarification is that new interim and draft prescriptions, if they ever are written, will not apply to conditioning applications. Approved prescriptions will continue to be required on applications. This is on line, on page 15, line 44, and on to page 16. And also on page 11, line 36, two places. We've also more clearly stated that FPA's forest practices applications in a mapped reanalysis area will be subject to the standard classification rules during the reanalysis. And this is found on page 17, line 10. Together, these clarifications take care of the long-standing problem of never finalizing some interim or draft prescriptions plus requiring applications to be conditioned with those longstanding interim draft prescriptions. I'm told there are 22 watershed analyses in varying stages of completion, some of which do still have draft and interim prescriptions. So if you decide to adopt rules today, staff will file a rulemaking order, which is a CR 103, with the Office of the Code Advisor, and the new rules will become effective 30 days after being published in the Washington State Register. So at this point, I'm happy to answer any questions you have. And I believe the economist, Craig Calhoun, no, yes?
No.
No? Is not here to answer questions.
Okay, so questions of staff. This is the final action that we need to take to adopt this rule, which, as with many others we've worked on over the last 12 to 18 months, has seen a lot of exhaustive input. Proposed action? Go ahead.
You can see it better.
I move the Forest Practice Board adopt the rule proposal that Ben supports in 322 WAC pertaining to watershed analysis reviews. The rulemaking amends rules to ensure watershed analysis prescriptions continue to address the potential for adverse effects on resources for forest practices activities to the greatest extent possible over time. I further move to direct staff to file a CR 103 rulemaking order with the Office of the Code Advisor.
Is there a second? Thank you, Norm. Okay. So that motion is properly supported.
Yeah,
is there a discussion on the motion? Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. Make that unanimous. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thank you, staff, for your hard work on this rule. And it's nice to see it over the finish line. So moving on. Still have 2 pages of work to do yet today. Gotta move on. Next item is a board manual, section 11, standard methodology for conducting watershed analysis.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and board members. My name is Donnell Mahan. I'm with the Forest Practices Division. Today, I'm here to request your approval of Part 8, the Review and Reanalysis Board Manual, and Appendix K, Mass Wasting Reanalysis, both to be incorporated into the updated Board Manual, Section 11, named Standard Methodology for Conducting Watershed Analysis. Part 8 is just a general overview of the review and reanalysis process. Appendix K provides specific guidance for the mass wasting reanalysis process. When you directed staff to amend the watershed analysis rule, it became necessary to amend these board manual sections. When we looked at the changes that were necessary, we also saw other improvements that could be made throughout the manual, such as clarification on contact information and segmenting the manual into parts instead of sections so that it is consistent with the other board manuals. Since the board mailing which you received, Part 8 has received an additional clarification to page 2 regarding discussion of HCPs. And if you go down, it is after number 5 at the top of your paper, at the top of the page, and the clarification, instead of stating that all landowners with HCPs will be exempt from the watershed analysis process, which was incorrect, we clarified that some landowners may be exempt from the watershed analysis process, depends on what they negotiated in their specific HCPs. During the writing of Part 8 and Appendix K, we asked for and received input from our external partners, as well as DNR Region and Division Forest Practices staff. Finally, Forests and Fish Policy gave its support for the revised manual at their March meeting. Do you have any questions?
Questions for staff?
Okay, I would like to request that you approve the amended board manual.
I move we approve.
So there's a motion if you'd like to make it.
I think I said it right. I move the Forest Practices Board approve Part 8 Review and Reanalysis and Appendix K, Mass Wasting and Reanalysis, to be incorporated into the updated Board Manual Section 11, Standard Methodology for Conducting Watershed Analysis. I further move to allow staff to make minor editorial changes if necessary prior to distribution. Only minor ones.
Got it.
Is there support for this motion?
I'll second.
That's fine. Okay. So, discussion on the motion. Call for a vote. All in favor, raise your hand. Thank you. That's unanimous. And thank you very much for your presentation. All right. So that takes care of Board Manual for Watershed Analysis. So now we get an update on watershed analysis review and prioritization process. Leslie?
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and members of the board. I'm Leslie Lingley. I'm the Forest Practices Science Team Lead. And I'm not asking you for any big decisions today, so that might be kind of fun. I'm just here to let you know what's happened with the prioritization process that I've come and talked to you about before. The first thing, I'm really happy that you passed the Appendix K, because we did have really good participation by the stakeholders, and I really appreciated all their input and commitment to helping us with that appendix. So I'm just gonna go through, I want to remind you guys we had 52 watershed analyses that we prioritized, and then I sent out letters to all the landowners that had 10% or more of the non-federal land in each watershed to determine what they thought they would be choosing from the three options that the subcommittee recommended, when those three options were A, to sponsor a watershed analysis. The second one was to participate by helping money or providing a qualified expert, and the third option was to select the option to adopt standard rules. So we sent out about 115 letters to landowners, and I got quite a lot of responses, and the responses kept moving on, so I didn't give you this spreadsheet because I didn't know what the response was going to be by the time the board, so I'll just tell you what happened. We had seven watershed analyses that were owned by West Fork Timber that we had already decided they had also always done a 5 or 10 year review, so they were exempt from the prioritization process. We have now two watershed analyses that are going to be reanalyzed. We have 23 watershed analyses that we don't have final numbers in, because mostly it's just one landowner that has not responded. We have 14 watershed analyses that have adopted, that would like to adopt the standard rules, and that includes on these 14, all the landowners in those watersheds had given me the information that they want to do this. And then we have six watersheds that have very, very low density of landslides in their watersheds. And I talked about this the last time I was here about we determined all the numbers of landslides by area and square miles. And if these are six watersheds that have very, very few landslides, it's 0.025 landslides per square mile. So it's not even one landslide per square mile. And these are mostly on the wet east side, with some watersheds that have 4 landslides, 7 landslides, or they're watersheds that have 240 square miles. So their density is they're very small density of landslides. So that adds up to 52 watersheds.
And do you have any questions about any of that for me before I go on to the next steps, what we're going to do? Okie doke. So the next things we're going to do is contact the landowners that have not replied and determine, and then we're going to schedule them for prioritization to do a watershed analysis. And at that time, at any time during their reanalysis, they can opt out to go to standard rules if they want. So as soon as I get the numbers of the watershed analyses that people are going to do a reanalysis, I'll prioritize those that list and notify the landowners with their schedule. If a landowner has multiple watershed analyses, we'll consider their order, but we'll take their number one priority first, and we won't ask them to do two at a time, because I figure it's going to take about 4 months to do this by the time they do all the rigmarole with the stakeholders and what has to happen to get this finalized. So that's happening. DNR, we will provide training for the qualified experts. We'll check in with them and make sure they're doing it the way we think they should do it, and then we'll help them finalize their prescriptions to the public and help them do their CEPA process. So that's where we stand.
All right.
Any questions?
Questions for staff on this? I think things are going rolling out along.
Okay. It's all great to see action.
Yeah, it's great to see action. It's always a little bit of a challenge to get everybody to reply.
Okay, thank you.
So the next item on today's agenda is an opportunity for public comment on riparian open space rulemaking and board manual section 18. So no one from the public has signed up to comment. So we can move right along to riparian open space program rulemaking. Now I want to get the pronunciation of your name right.
Okay, it's Donnell.
Donnell.
Mahan.
Okay, thank you, Donnell.
Welcome
back.
Thanks. Okay, I'm back. I'm requesting your adoption, and I'm going to refer to this as the Rivers and Habitat Open Space Program, since that's what we will be moving towards. But the adoption of the rule and approval of Board Manual Section 18, Guidelines for Rivers and Habitat Open Space Program. I'm going to do something a little different, go through both the rule and the board manual together, and give you a brief overview of what I will be calling ROSP, which is the shorthand for what I just stated. The rulemaking was due to legislation that passed in April 2009 that amended the Riparian Open Space Program to include forest lands containing board-approved critical habitat for threatened and endangered species, as well as habitat within unconfined avulsine channel migration zones. For your direction, from the board meeting on February 8th, staff initiated public review of this rulemaking by filing a pre-proposal initiation CR 102 with the Code Revisor's Office, conducted hearings and CEPA review. We received two comments, both which were positive. For the board manual, we asked for and received input from our external partners, as well as DNR Region and Division Forest Practices staff. I want to thank all the people that participated in this. This was my first board manual, and it was actually a really fun experience. Made a lot of headway quickly, and everybody was quite productive. The board manual guides landowners through the ROSP application process and explains the eligibility and prioritization criteria. Do you have any questions regarding the rule or the board manual? Nope. Okay, I ask that request that you move forward to adopt the rule by directing staff to file the CR 103 with the Office of the Code Revisor.
That would be whose turn is it?
Are you going to
go
to? I have to turn around.
Spread the joy.
I move that the Forest Practices Board adopt the rule proposal that amends portions of Title 222 WAC relating to the expansion of the Riparian Open Space Program and direct staff to file a CR 103 rulemaking order with the Office of the Code Revisor.
Okay, thank you. I have a motion properly supported to adopt the rule proposal and amend the board manual.
I'll get to that.
Okay.
This is just for
you
the
still
rule.
Have to get
yeah.
to that?
Yes.
So do we need to review that before we adopt the rule? Is this due both at the same time?
That's what I did was I rolled them both into one. So we'll just adopt the rule first, and then we'll move to the approval of the board manual.
Okay. All right. So a motion. So is there discussion on the motion? Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. It's unanimous. Thank you very much. You're very convincing today.
Okay. So, okay. The second one. So,
so the rule is adopted. So let's move on to
see
board manual.
Twice as nice.
Yep.
I'm now going to ask for you to approve the board manual.
All right, don't be shy. Okay, Tom.
I move that the Forest Practices Board approve Board Manual Section 18 guidelines for rivers and habitat open space program and allow staff to make minor editorial changes if necessary prior to distribution.
Second. Dave, I've got Sorry. Dave for a second. Okay, we have a motion properly supported to approve the Section 18 of the Board Manual. Discussion on the motion.
Sure. I have a question. Publisher questioned you back here, but I just caught it here.
Okay.
on the eligibility requirements or qualifying lands, under the rule of qualifying lands, is there any legislation or instruction for you to exclude nonprofits from being able to qualify for receiving funds?
Not that I'm aware of, but I have our resident expert, Dan.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Dan Palmerick. I work in the Small Forest Landowners Office and Forest Practices Division. And no, there is there's no nothing that that addresses the nonprofits.
What about in your prioritization? Nothing there that puts them like down at the bottom or anything like that?
No.
How many nonprofits have gotten money from the work in open space?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I can answer that. I don't believe there are any, but I would have to check.
So it hasn't been used like the threat was?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I know one, perhaps, but it's, I don't have firm information.
Yeah, that's why I didn't want to say definitely yeah. not. I guess possibility.
Yeah.
Would you like me to get back to you on that?
I guess it doesn't matter because we just passed the rule.
And it did go through the legislature, too.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think it was thought about. I wasn't involved in the negotiations on this, so I don't think it was thought about that it should be used for forests that aren't already being conserved.
It is a much smaller list of people that we've acquired. In repairing open space then threat, so it would be an easy list to get to you.
Okay. Then maybe you could just report that to the board. That'd be helpful.
Okay.
Great.
Any other questions for staff? Okay, so I think we're at the point where we have a motion. It's supported. It's time for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. All right. Thank you, board. That's unanimous. Thank you, staff.
Thank you.
Appreciate your support and help. So we're moving right along. We're not going to take a break right now. We might later if you're good. So we'll move along to public comment on the charter for the PFW/Cultural Resources Committee. So public comment on this, okay? Let's see the staff saying we don't have any public comment. So I think, let's see, Jeffrey's here. I see Peter's here. Great. Come forward, you guys, please, and present your charter for our possible approval.
Thank you, Commissioner and members of the board. I have to tell you that Jeffrey and I have not prepared for this presentation, so we won't be quite as smooth as staff has been, but we will present to you the the charter that has been developed by the Cultural Resources Committee in cooperation with the Commissioner's Office and DNR staff. And I think I'll just give you just a little bit of background as to why we feel this charter is important. Jeffrey really has most of the history of the Cultural Resource Committee. I've been involved with it for 10 or 15 years now. But when Forest and Fish came along, there was a large adaptive management program put together that was very structured with a policy group and a CEMA group. And the Cultural Resource Committee, TFW Cultural Resource Committee, was continuing to work as it had under the original TFW for many years, but didn't seem to really have a home, didn't really have anyone, I think, as we put it, to report to. So we had attempted to go to the Policy Committee and to CEMER and to see if that's where we might find a home, and that didn't materialize for one reason or another. And so then we decided to approach the board, and I think we did that, I don't know, a couple of years ago, actually. And actually, I ended up having a meeting with the commissioner and his staff, decided that a charter would be an appropriate thing to do, and then that was about a year ago, and I've been working on it ever since. So, before you, and maybe what I'll do, Jeff, do you want to take part of this?
I sure would. I guess if we're just sort of recapping some of the history and the need and the significance of the charter and its benefits it would have for all TFW stakeholders, I also would like to underscore that this cultural archaeological resources were identified in the original Timber Fish and Wildlife Agreement as one of the five primary objectives, along with viability of the timber industry and protecting water resources, wildlife resources, fish resources. Cultural resources was there as well. And it's been a mixed bag of provisions and responses and sensitivity to cultural resources over the years. I know that there was an original cultural archaeological steering committee that was established. You'll see it represented in the TFW introductory booklet, which is an accompaniment to the original TFW agreement, author uncertain. But it's there identified in the organizational chart as something that was pertinent and relevant to implementing the original TFW agreement. That group did produce some recommendations that were presented under the auspices of the Blaylock Report, and it's been a while since I've seen my copy of the Blaylock Report, but it had some very interesting and useful recommendations that in 1994 I was able to highlight for the TFW Policy Group, and at that time they reconstituted the TFW Cultural Committee. That group has served continuously since that time. I did focus on four primary original goals that we can always specify for you at a later time. But when we presented back on our work pertaining to those goals in 1986, we were instructed to then develop an implementation plan for protecting cultural resources during forest practices activities. The group continued to work diligently on a monthly basis and had some very worthwhile and promising recommendations that it was about to make to the timber, fish, and wildlife stakeholders. Continued on right up until the advent of forest and fish negotiations. We even presented our work at the original forest and fish negotiations retreat. Everybody's energies were focused on something different, on finalization of the forest and fish negotiation work products. And luckily enough, we were able to tack on to the very end of the Forest and Fish Report, Provision 03, along with what you also find under funding and watershed analysis. And it's served as a basis for the group to yet continue their work even more. You heard from us again in August of 2003 when we presented to you the Cultural Resources Protection Management Plan, which did include a cultural module, which, by the way, we still need to do some field testing with, along with some revisions for the WACs. Some guidelines for implementing 22220120 notification of forest practices to affected Indian tribes. So that being a little bit of a backdrop, then we're here before you again today for reasons and purposes such as Peter stated. But the charter, in my opinion, is probably long overdue and been very long in coming for the TFW stakeholder community. And we both look forward to offering our own services and energies towards fulfillment of the spirit and provisions of the original Timber Fish and Wildlife Agreement and the successor Forest and Fish Report, along with any provisions found in RCW statutes or Washington Administrative Code laws pertaining to cultural resources in the way that they might be integrated with the rest of the resources that in the focus of the agreement. So with that, I'll go ahead and pass it back to Peter.
Okay. Let's see. First thing is the name change. And we are no longer the TFW Cultural Resources Committee. We will become a Cultural Resources, TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable. And the reason for that is, as I understand it, we are not a committee of the board. We are a roundtable that's here to help and advise the board. So let me give you the purpose, and I'll just read it because that's the easiest way to do it. The purpose of the roundtable is to foster cooperative protection and management of cultural resources as envisioned in the Cultural Resources Protection and Management Plan, which we provided to the board earlier and the board approved. The roundtable facilitates the identification, protection, and management of cultural resources that are significant to the history and culture of people of the state of Washington and which are located on state and non-federal forest lands. The roundtable supports improved tribal access to traditional tribal resources. The roundtable serves the needs of the board by providing insights on cultural resource issues affecting forest practices by providing consensus, and I think that's an important aspect of what we do, providing consensus rulemaking recommendations for the board's consideration and annually reporting to the board on behalf of the department on how the implementation of the Cultural Resources Protection and Management Plan is working. So we have a broad membership, primarily of landowners and our landowner representatives, in that we have a state lands archaeologist on our committee, as well as large and small landowner representatives. A number of tribes are participating in the committee, and we get a lot of help from David Powell of the Yakima Nation, who's our keeper of the records. Let's see, we have a variety of responsibilities and tasks, and I'm not going to go through and list all these, but let me just say that our primary job is to review cultural issues that come up and bring to the board, as I said earlier, consensus recommendations on what the board may do in terms of rule or manual development. We will be, again, delivering those recommendations to the board. We're currently working on we've just finished work on a rule you'll hear about a little later in the day, and we're currently working on we don't know if it's quite a manual or guidance. We haven't really settled on that. Actually, we're thinking it belongs on a website, which seems to be the most modern way of communicating to the public, and we'll be putting together guidance materials for people to, first of all, meet all the current rules that are in place, which is probably more than most people think, because there's some rules on archaeology and human remains and such that reside in other places in the state laws, and then also the forest practices rules, both in the definitions of Class 4 Special and in the notification of tribes section of the rules, which I'll hear about later. We'll be delivering, as we have in the past, annual reports and actually quarterly reports and annual reports. And I just want to say a little bit about the group process. We truly do operate as an open group. Anyone that's representing one of the six caucuses of forest and fish is welcome to come to the committee. The general public is welcome to come if they so choose. And we do operate on a consensus basis. We don't bring things to you until we have a solid consensus. And sometimes that takes a long time. So, just to wrap up, we would appreciate it if you would go ahead and approve this this charter.
Well, thank you for the presentation, and thank you for all the hard work and effort both of you and others have put into this effort. Just the nuance for the board, there are committees of the board, but they are consisted of board members. So this is obviously a group that's not consisting of board members, and hence the need for the name change. But also the name change has provided an opportunity to really look at what the group is doing and come forward with this charter. So I think it's It helps, I think it helps a group have a discussion about what they're really about and inform the board through this charter as to what their ambitions and their goals are. I think it's very helpful for both the roundtable and for the board. Tom.
Yeah, I agree. This is great to see. I like the name change. I like the idea of a charter. I think that's a good step forward. I had a question, and Peter, you might have answered this already. On the deliverables list on the, your back page, the third item is developing educational tools for landowners and land managers. And you may have already mentioned what the main thing you're working on is. I just see that as a real viable area, you know, because ignorance gets us into a lot of trouble. And early information, accessible information can really help. I'm just curious other things might be doing.
Our current efforts are focused on getting something up for the website, which I didn't bring it with me, but we have a list of tasks and we pass them out amongst the committee members. And we will, over the next few months, be working on a general, I guess, guidance and background for cultural and archaeological resources, forest lands.
Would that include, like, recognizing?
Yeah, to the extent that we can. You have to realize we have no staff. Sherry Felix helps us some, but she is a representative of the Forest Practices Division on the committee on the roundtable. She's not a staff person. David Powell does a tremendous amount of work for us, but again, he's representing his tribe, his employer, and not a staff person. So we do all these things without staff, and they take a long time. We could do a lot more, and we could be a lot more illustrations and a lot more things we could do if we did have that help, but we don't. So we're plugging along the best we can with what we have, and eventually we want to develop a educational and training program. We're willing to participate if someone else has a program and would like us to come and talk about what we do, but we haven't put that together yet, and it's certainly on the list.
I just encourage you to consider, I don't know if there's possibilities out there, but private funding, perhaps, for a specific project related to educating people about that.
Maybe worth mentioning is the Forest Practices Illustrated Booklet. That's a place where people can look to. There are a number of public forums that the committee has been invited to participate in, such as the Cultural Resources Planning Summit that's now, I believe, going to be in its third year. But we're not really always asked to present. There's probably a wide range of opportunity for more committee and roundtable involvement, if you will, that we really haven't strategized ourselves to participate in. We oftentimes talk, at one point we were developing a fairly, prepared PowerPoint presentation to talk about the Cultural Resources Protection Management Plan and all of the provisions and opportunities that are represented by that document. We would welcome every opportunity to talk more about our group and how it integrates with the rest of the TFW stakeholder effort, as well as the non-TFW efforts that are represented by both forest resource management here in the state, or even management of forests as they are converted into other types of land uses. At least in the Puyallup area, much of the previously forested land has long since been converted into a different land use, but that doesn't necessarily negate the idea that there are archaeological resources still associated with those former environments. Oftentimes my program will be called in to talk about those former environments and be sure that the archaeological interpretations are being set forth in the proper context. I have a meeting with a landowner on that very topic tomorrow in the Bonnie Lake area. And that's a forest that is about to be approved as a Class 3 forest practice application. But of course, we've raised questions about shouldn't it really be a Class 4? And there's just an awful lot of work that really needs to be done when it comes to honoring the state statutes and laws pertaining to cultural archaeological resources. especially knowing that you cannot knowingly harm them. But from my perspective, if you don't detect, it's pretty hard to protect. And so there's an awful lot of educational need that's out there for both large forest landowners in the upper parts of the watershed, where you usually don't have a firmly established record of archaeological survey and testing methodologies, let alone efforts and findings and conclusions, or for the small forest landowners lower down in the watershed, who of course are always in need of assistance services, especially when it comes to topics and disciplines that aren't that well established, such as detection for archaeological upon their small forest lands, which in great part are usually the ones that are of highest productivity within the watershed when it comes to fish and animals and other resources like that. So there's a big need for cultural archaeological resource sensitivity and the mechanisms provided for them, whether it's tribal, non-tribal, or just the overall stakeholder discussion as a whole.
All right, well, thank you for that. Board members, a motion would be appropriate at this time.
I'll move that the Forest Practices Board accept the charter presented by the TFW Cultural Resources Committee that renames the committee as the Timberfish Wildlife Cultural Resources Roundtable and establishes the roundtable to report to the establishes the roundtable to report to the board on cultural resource issues.
Second.
You made the second.
I don't care.
We'll give Anna the distinction this time.
Right.
So we have a motion. Thank you for that. Properly supported.
Before you call for a vote, Commissioner, I'd just like to clarify that there is one small change to the charter where we have suggested removing applicability of the Open Public Meetings Act to this group. I think Mr. Heidi's done a great job of explaining how the group operates in an open and public manner. But because the group has no set membership, it would be impossible to determine a quorum for purposes of Open Public Meetings Act business, and therefore we're suggesting that small change. And you might want to clarify whether the motion is as to the changed version of the charter.
Well, so you, are you going to call that a change or an amendment? But as presented here to the board, it's been deleted.
Okay. Right.
So it's. I think we're proposing to adopt it as it is.
Correct. Thank you.
So that's clear to the board members? Okay. I think so. We have a motion properly supported. Discussion on the motion. Call for a vote.
Just got to congratulate Pete and Jeffrey.
Let's pass it, and then we can. All those in favor, raise your hand. Thank you. Motion passes, and now
the moment has passed. great work, long time for both of you focused on these issues. Jeffrey, you've been there a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for the hard work.
Thank you very much.
Moving on to the next item on this afternoon's agenda is an opportunity for public comment on notice of forest practice to affected Indian tribe grooming. Okay, so no public comment on this proposal. And so I get to welcome back Sherry Felix. Yep, I see that.
All right. Again, good afternoon, Chair, members of the board. I am still Sherry Felix with the Forest Practices Division, and it's my pleasure now to bring you good news on rule development for your WAC titled Notice of Forest Practices to Affected Indian Tribes. After a brief background and explanation of recommended changes, I will be asking your approval to move this rulemaking to the 30-day review process required by the Forest Practices Act. A year ago, almost to the day, at your May 2010 meeting, you approved notifying the public of possible rulemaking on this rule by filing a pre-proposal statement of inquiry, commonly referred to as a CR 101. Since then, as you just heard, the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable has continued their work to resolve issues with the current rule language.
Today, the draft rule language in your board packet is a consensus product from the TFW Cultural Resources Roundtable. The draft language is intended to clarify ambiguous language and resolve issues with the current rule language that requires landowner tribe meeting when a forest practices application involves a cultural resource. Also included in the rule language is a needed correction to the Western Washington RMZ clumping strategy, which simply replaces old Class 4 special language with the new language adopted by the board in 2008. Given the number of changes proposed in the committee's draft language, I will briefly describe those changes and the reasons for them. And I ask that you have your rule language out if you haven't already, so you can follow along. To clarify ambiguous language, the roundtable proposes two changes. First, in subsection 1, DNR is currently required to notify tribes of, quote, all applications of concern to such tribe. Problem is that tribes cannot tell DNR what applications they are concerned about until they first review the application. The purpose of this subsection 1 is so tribes have the opportunity to review the FPAs. The proposed change bases DNR's notice to the tribes on the geographic areas of interest the tribes have designated. And they have done this through the FPARS reviewer profiles that all reviewers need to fill out based on their interest in the geographic areas around the state, and which also supply them an opportunity for specific types of forest practices that they're interested in. So the change is from applications of concern to geographic areas of concern. The second proposed change for clarifying ambiguous language is in the beginning of subsection 2. Subsection 2 sets up the required landowner tribe meetings when an application involves a cultural resource. So the current rule refers to applications that involve cultural resources, but the problem is that term is not clear. So the proposed change clarifies that these applications are within the geographic area designated by the tribes as per subsection 1, and that that application contains a cultural resource. In other words, it's within the boundaries of the application, not involving somewhere or could be linked somehow. So this is a clarification that we're recommending so that DNR, the tribes, and the landowners and the operators know exactly which applications are being affected. To resolve problems regarding the required landowner tribe meetings, also in subsection 2, there are two changes. Again, subsection 2. The current rule requires a meeting when an application involves a cultural resource. Period. There's no out. There's no out even if the tribe is not concerned about the application or has no interest in that particular application. So what the committee has done is added the words, at the tribe's discretion. The landowner shall meet at the tribe's discretion. This gets around the situation where a tribe is simply not interested. Going on to...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Where exactly is that change?
It is in subsection 2, line 11.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, you betcha. Okay. So, we've added at the tribe's discretion to take care of that issue. We have also added a brand new subsection 3. It sets up standards for completing the meeting requirement. This is all new language. It's based on the concepts from the Cultural Resources Protection and Management Plan and from the good faith effort that's described in the National Tribal Historic Preservation, the National Association of Tribal Historic Preservation Officers, which demonstrates a good faith effort. So subsection 3, for all to see now, is what DNR is going to use to determine whether the meeting requirement in subsection 2 has been met. And there's a variety of things in there. The landowner can meet with the tribe, and that'll do it. That's sub A. The department receives written notice from the tribe that it's declining a meeting. That's B. The tribe does not respond to the landowner's attempts for whatever reason. They're not interested, they're too busy, somebody's on vacation, you know, whatever it might be. And there's two ways, using due diligence and a good faith effort, that the landowner is still able to receive an application if they have not received a response from the tribe and they complete section C, both parts. And then we've added a kind of a catch-all, the department receives other acceptable documentation. We didn't want to close the window completely, we wanted to leave some creativity in there. So, the last change we are proposing is to create a new subsection 4 that simply takes one sentence on conditioning authority out of subsection 2 and transfers it without language change to subsection 4 so the whole WAC flows better. I'm sure I've forgotten a whole lot of what I was going to say. So if there are any questions, there's multiple changes here. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them now.
Tom?
I'm looking at 3C. The two little subsections. The idea here, I understand, is quite understandable. This is the good faith effort to contact. But the terminology here, the tribe's designated cultural resources contact, mm-hmm. I mean, what if the tribe doesn't have a designated culture? I mean, that could be the problem, right?
That is part of the problem.
But so if they right don't now. Have one, you can't provide written documentation or email attempts.
Yes.
And you can't do a certified letter because all that is contingent on the tribe having a designated cultural resources.
All the tribes except one, all the federally recognized tribes except one, are signed up via FPARS to receive applications. There are cultural resources people on the list for the tribes.
Are they designated though?
Well, it's the tribe's designated person.
Yeah.
And so I know it's it's not complete. We're still working on it, but the tribe has to designate their contact person. We can't designate their contact person.
Well, I understand that, but
that's the language.
Yeah, well, I'm just not sure if it's very helpful if you're mm-hmm. if you have the same dilemma that you started with. One way to get around that would be to the chief executive officer of the tribe, for instance, a certified letter. I'm not saying that's a good solution,
right.
But you can identify that position, and therefore you can send a certified letter to somebody. But if you don't know if the tribe has a designated cultural, mm-hmm. I mean, you could have several people in the cultural department, mm-hmm. but if you don't know that somebody is designated for forest practices purpose, you can't really fulfill this obligation, it seems to me. So I just was wondering if there might be a better way of
if you can think of it, let us know. We've been around the full circle on this one, and there are tribes who we would have to speak with their business council. We would have to go to their elders. We would have to, you know, and you simply can't do that in the timeline that DNR is required to approve or disapprove an application. So we're coming at it from this angle. And going to be contacting each tribe to verify that there is one person on the FPARS reviewer profile that will be their designated contact person. We would also like a backup for that too. But that's how we're trying to approach this. It's not foolproof by any means.
Yeah.
Dave? I'll just point out all these subsections are ORs, so there's multiple paths here to get there, so they don't have a designated person.
Right, any one of these meets the meeting requirement.
Well, this is the non-responsive section.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the challenge.
It is a challenge.
And you have to do both, and these are and. The two little I and double I's are and.
So they're in an or.
Well, I mean, but the whole section is an or. Yeah. Anyway, I'm just sympathetic to the.
No, comments are well taken, and it's been a struggle getting to this point to try to put in language something we think has a potential to work.
Doug? Sherry, the way the college works, and I sure like it, is they're notified by the DNR on any FPAs, and then they notify us. And if there's anything, you know, they just say, if there's anything there, will you please let us know? Mm-hmm. And then so, and to me, that's a surefire deal, and we're getting that straight from the designated cultural resource person mm-hmm. of the tribe. Mm-hmm. And I think they're happy with it.
Yes, I believe they are. And I know the Yakimas have set up certain things with certain landowners.
So is there something wrong with that way working? I mean, the way this is one more step here that the landowner would have to initiate the contact. And the way it's working now is with the college, yeah, they're notified that we got an FPA, and then they send us a letter.
I believe we didn't try to, we tried to provide options so that would be workable too. It's the actual end result that we're looking for.
Okay. Yeah,
and there are a variety of ways to get there.
Okay.
And we didn't want to be so prescriptive that you had to do it your way or you had to do it the way the Yakimas are doing it because there's a variety of ways to meet the objective.
Yeah. Okay. Tom? A question for both you and put Anna on the spot here potentially, but on thinking under the light of FPA HPA integration, if indeed that successful moves down the road, there's also a tribal notification requirement under HPAs, and I can't remember how that's facilitated. But just to throw that out, whether or not that's something you guys had thought about in discussing, since the tribes are also interested in reviewing the HPAs as well. So if there's a way to integrate that process, or if that's even worth considering.
I'll make a note of that. Thank you.
So I can just add to that currently it was a pilot project. Now it's been expanded to all tribes. The ability to view our HPA system, where all the HPAs are stored, HPMS. So that is, it's not the same as FPARS, where you get an email notification, but all tribes have the ability to view that system, so that's how we're providing that notice right now. So if we need to work together.
Yeah, I'd like to look into it further. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Commissioner, other questions, comments?
Yeah, I was just wondering, so the line 17, subsection 3, I'm wondering if the reference is supposed to be to subsection 1 instead of 2. Because you're referring to the requirements that I think are the notification requirements?
Misread that? Let me try to answer your question and see if I get it.
Okay.
Subsection 1 is the department's responsibility to send applications to the tribes to review. Subsection 2 is what needs to happen when one of those applications involves a cultural resource. So I believe we have correctly stated that it's subsection 2. Maybe we should add meeting requirements in subsection 2 to be more clear. That was the idea.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
So just to remind the board, there'll be future opportunities to make further, to suggest further amendments to the rule language. We're just getting started here with the 101.
with a 30-day.
Norm? Would you like other suggestions before we have a motion or afterwards?
Well, let's get the motion up, then we can have further suggestions.
Okay, so if you approve proceeding today with a 30-day review process, staff will distribute the draft language to the counties and Fish and Wildlife and the tribes for their review and comment. Then staff will draft cost-benefit analysis, small business economic impact statement, and complete a CEPA checklist for threshold determination. And I believe there's a motion draft.
How convenient. So, you want to make that motion, Norm?
Well, I would like to make an amendment to the rule language, so I'm not sure where it's appropriate.
Well, if you make the motion, then the rule language
I'll
is on
that.
The table.
Okay, so I will make the motion. I move that the Forest Practices Board accept the draft rule proposal for a 30-day review with the counties, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and tribes that amends WAC 222-20-120, notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes, and corrects WAC 222-30-21 sub 1 sub C sub II, Western Washington Riparian Management Zone clumping strategy.
Is there a second for the motion? Okay, thank you. So you have a proposal to change the draft language?
Yeah, it's modest. This will be in WAC 222-20-120, 3C-I. This is line 27. And it will be to delete the and replace it with an or. You have two ways in which landowner can make notification or receive notification back from the tribe that they've tried to consult and the tribe declines. It seems redundant to require both methods when one could suffice. And it seems an additional requirement on the landowner to have to send out a set, perhaps, of certified letters when they've made email communication.
So let me just ask staff, was it the intent to require both, or was it the intent to require either?
It was the intent to require both.
Why?
Because we were going for a good faith effort. And a good faith effort, in our opinion, is more than sending each of the tribes one letter and calling it good.
Or an email.
This might be obvious to all of you, but I'm not certain. This language has been in the Cultural Resources Roundtable for some time. This was their product. We certainly helped out as board staff and did the paperwork that's required to bring it to you. But this language was negotiated long and hard within the committee.
So,
I don't disagree with the need to make a good faith effort and to contact the appropriate people, and according to the procedures that we've just heard, we will know who the appropriate people are and we will have an ability to contact them. As I say, it seems redundant to have to do both, especially if an email does actually get to the point. An email with a response that says we don't care or you tried. There are certainly technological ways of doing it without having to double our efforts and just cause an additional step in the process.
Okay, so you're making that an amendment?
I would propose that as an amendment to change that and to or.
Is there support for the proposal? Doug?
I'll support it.
Okay. So we have a motion properly supported to change on line 17. I believe it's 17. No, it's on line 27. The and to an or. Discussion on the motion. Tom?
I'm sympathetic, Norm. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I think that the process, the consensus group that has worked on this has, you know, kind of gone over this territory. So I think I'm going to stick with the proposal at this point. at least for going out for public comment. But I do understand your point. I appreciate it.
Dave?
I agree with Tom. I think A, B, C, and D are four different paths. You can make the requirement there are four different paths. And this is simply C has two elements to it, but I don't think it's one of those. If you take the and out, somebody can just send an email. That's all it says. Written documentation that there's been an email attempt to meet, and that seems pretty weak to me.
It could be weak
in some cases. So I think the language as stands provides a lot of flexibility. Even the department deciding they've got acceptable documentation would be so. I like the language as well.
Yeah.
Just going to second what Tom also had said. Just want to respect the work that the roundtable has done so far and going into the public review process. So
let's remember, this is all for public, you know, it's got some distance to go here, folks. Any other comment? Okay, call for a vote on the proposed amendment. All those in favor of the amendment to change the and to an or, raise your hand. See one, two. Okay, two opposed. One, two, three, four, five, six. How are you voting, Jerry? Seven, eight, nine. Okay, nine opposed. Motion fails. Give it another chance.
Understand.
Any other proposals? So you got the vote over there? Okay. Any other proposals before we move on? So we have a motion now then to accept the following draft rule proposal. Is there further discussion on the underlying motion to go forward with the draft language? Call for a vote on that. All those in favor, raise your hand. Okay, that's unanimous. Thank you, members of the board. Appreciate that. So I think that completes that part, right?
Yes,
that what you came for.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Cheryl. So, board members, we're now within, I think we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. However, we're not quite there yet. You will note we have a choice at this point. You want to push on? We've got one more rulemaking and then a work plan and budget. You want to push on or do you want to take about a 6 minute break?
Push on.
Okay, here we go. So now's an opportunity for public comment on forest biomass rulemaking. Has anyone signed up? Okay, nobody signed up on that. Thank you for the public's restraint there. And now we get to a forest biomass review. Bridget? Good afternoon, Bridget.
Good afternoon, Commissioner, members of the board. I'm here today to give you an update on the biomass phase two activities that I have been involved in. Well, you'll hear when I'm through about the phase one and the completion of that portion of the rulemaking from staff, but I'm talking about the step that comes after that. So we convened a group back at the beginning of the year under the commissioner's direction to staff to do so. We've had a couple of meetings now. Those meetings and notes have been posted onto the Forest Practices Board's website. And I wanted to just give you a brief update as to where that group is. So what you have in front of you is a proposed schedule to address all components of the rules as they pertain to the harvest of forest biomass. This is, I think this morning's statement on this was that it is an aggressive timeline, likely, but it's kind of how we roll at DNR right now, trying to get things done in a timely fashion with limited staff. So we're going to try to get through a fairly significant assessment of the rules as they pertain to biomass to be able to make a recommendation and a handoff to policy so that any activity that the board decides to undertake, they'd be well informed to do so. So the group meets, has, like I said, has met a few times. There is, it's an ad hoc group. Members are anybody who wishes to attend may attend. We've been attempting to include all those who wish to participate. So far, membership has included members of DNR, the timber industry, the environmental community, our sister state and federal agencies, and members of the biomass industry. And it's been a good discussion. We've been talking about essentially what will go into effect if you approve the rule today, and then what is left beyond that for us to look at. We haven't gotten into detailed substance on that, but we have talked about a couple of field trips with an opportunity to look at essentially what does it look like on the landscape when biomass harvest occurs. And so we will be, our group will be attempting to do that this spring. And then following that, you can see as it's outlined month by month through the next year, looking at different components of the rules and other recommendations that have been made nationwide or internationally relevant to the impact of biomass harvest. So this is just an update to let you know that the group continues to meet, that there is a draft schedule that will be difficult for us to stay on, but we are committed to doing so. And with that, I could answer any questions.
Just a quick process question. I know that David Whipple's been going, he's been able to come to a couple meetings, but just in terms of who on the email list is getting things like this timeline and the charter,
right.
Are you basing it just off of who's been attending, or is there kind of a standing list?
David and I had this conversation earlier because he was not available for the last meeting and he missed this, so we clarified that. The intent is to include everybody who has participated in the meetings and anybody who wishes to be on the mailing list. And so we updated that this morning when we realized that he wasn't getting the materials.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So just to make sure that the board understands what's going on, phase one is what we're going to consider immediately after this, which is proposed rulemaking and adopting CR 103, minor amendment into the current rule. And then phase two, we're really trying to anticipate through this conversation that Bridget's been leading with the many constituents about what, if anything else, needs to be done besides this proposed rule that we're going to consider. So there are two different issues going forward. Norm.
Given the board staff's workload and plan coming up, and at least from what I've heard, no real evidence that we have an issue that we're trying to solve, it seems like we have a solution in search of a problem here, spending a lot of time on biomass. Now that we've reached a point of making sure that biomass harvest is a regulated forest practice, and it has been done in that manner up until this point in time, but what we're considering today clarifies that. To take this to some unknown phase two in the absence of any real evidence that we have a problem out there makes me question why we're devoting board time and staff time to this subject, or should it go through the typical adaptive management process? If there are water quality issues or if there are fish issues, rather than us developing this as a new process, a new procedure, and again, spending an awful lot of time and expense in this area.
Just to be clear here, the board involvement, I think Bridget is just informing the board about what is going on in the background, and I would anticipate, and I think you already mentioned, that if there were anything that were contemplated, would be handed off to policy. So. And the stakeholders are all being involved in the whole discussion.
Oh, I understand that. Yeah, but just like I said, I think we've got a solution in search of a problem here when we just haven't seen any kind of documentation come before this board that suggests that we really have an issue to deal with based on the harvest of the very limited harvest of biomass from our forest operations.
I think we need to look before we know. That's the issue. Yes, Tom.
Thank you. Bridget, this looks great. I mean, I really like to see this analysis. It is a lot of work, I see, and I'm a little bit sympathetic with Norm. We don't know what the problem is, but I think we do have to take a close look at it. There's a lot of concerns around it. This looks like it'll do it. The only thing that I have a little bit of concern with is the ad hoc nature of the group. you're going to have some people that go to all of these, and they're going to be very well informed. You're going to have some people that are hit and miss, and that can be awkward to deal with at the end when you're trying to put it all together. So just encourage you to try to keep at least a core group all the way through this. Maybe give them a gold star if they complete the whole course.
They seem to be really interested, so they keep showing up.
Yeah.
So, but when I say it's ad hoc, that invites other participants as needed. But there are certainly a core group of folks that expressed a keen interest in attending all the meetings.
I just wanted to note, somewhat in response to your statement, Norm, is that we have heard testimony from the public in prior meetings of concern about what could happen in the future. And I think that, and I just wanted to state that I appreciate DNR's responsiveness to that, and I think it's good to hear what all the stakeholder concerns are and have a process where everybody can learn more and express their concerns. And it is, in some sense, it's preemptive, and in some sense, it's adaptive. And there may not turn out to be an issue, but it's good to learn. And I think it's also good to put information collecting processes in place that help us figure out whether or not there can be a problem in the future. So I think it's one of those rare times when a government body and citizens are getting together to try to prevent problems and conflict in the future. And so I think that it's time well spent.
I think we've just heard kind of both of the polls of what we've heard in the group, which is different perspectives of whether this is necessary or that it is necessary, and concerns about future expansion, which is the reason why we wanted to do the analysis of sort of section by section through the rules and then hand that off to policy, so that if there is something that we see that, from a thorough analysis, where there's any area of a gap, that we could hand that off and then be done with it and not have it have a question come later if and when the industry really does take off.
Do you have further comment?
I just wanted to echo also my great appreciation for DNR's leadership here, and Norm, just in response to you too, I know our support of the initial rulemaking was contingent upon some kind of investigation of the phase two, because there is a lot that we don't know and that we need to look into, I think, before we can be fully aware of what we are getting into with biomass. So.
I acknowledge we've heard a lot of concern. Don't agree that we've heard a lot of science or a lot of fact, and until we have something that we can base at least some little bit of time and workload on, it seems like we've got a lot of really important things that this board is trying to accomplish, that forest practice staff is trying to accomplish, and this one is, in my opinion, pretty far down on the list.
I would also add that through the commissioner's leadership and having biomass as a major initiative within the department, in legislation that was just passed and signed by the governor, a requirement for an update on the board's attention to evaluating its rules and the relationship to forest biomass harvest is a requirement of reporting for us. So we've been directed by the legislature to ensure that our rules are at least looked at to understand if biomass harvest is sufficiently evaluated. So we have that additional responsibility.
Dave?
I'd like to get notice of particularly the biomass tour. I have the opportunity to see some of these things in the field. Maybe the other board members would.
Yeah. Well, then it becomes a different tour.
So. Yeah. We have to be careful about that core quorum, right?
Right. Or is it any?
No, just the core.
We can't have a quorum.
Right.
Unless the board chooses at another time to make that a focus of a tour, but we will certainly have these to listing.
All right, Bridget, thank you for that update. Darren?
I want to clarify one thing. There's nothing automatic here. Any adaptive management proposal, should that come out of this, would come to you first before it went anywhere. So just to clarify.
Okay. Just background. All right, so then moving on to the phase one, we have forest biomass rulemaking. Gretchen?
Commissioner, if I could ask the question of Darren.
Of course.
Darren, we've just set and passed at least two or three new rules for forest practices. And as you may recall, within the rule on the 15-year permit, it requires that the Forest Practice Board do an analysis to determine whether or not 15 new permits should be affected. I know we did it with DFC. My question is, did we do it with the rules we just passed?
Yes, we did.
We did?
Yeah, staff didn't mention that, but we did on all three.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. And they're not backed on the 15-year permits.
How do you document that, Gretchen?
Well, I thought they did. I thought the others did in the memos. And in my memo, it just talks about the fact that we're going to add a field on the FPA to find out people's plans on forest biomass removal. So it wasn't documented before, because there wasn't a field on the FPA or a question in the FPAs to solicit for that information.
As long as it's being done.
Yes, it is being done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a great database that we use now developed.
Cool.
Okay, so let's go on to rulemaking, please.
All right. So, Commissioner Goldmark and board members, good afternoon. I'm Gretchen Robinson, and I work in the Forest Practices Division of the Department of Natural Resources. And today I'm here to request that you adopt the Forest Biomass Rule. The rule amends the definition of forest practice in WAC 2221610, and that's the definitions chapter, by inserting the words or forest biomass into the lead-in sentence of that definition. And the purpose of this rule is to make it clear that forest biomass harvest is subject to the same resource protection measures as timber harvest in the Forest Practices Rules. At your February meeting, you directed staff to file a CR 102 proposed rulemaking notice to initiate rulemaking, and the language was published in the Washington State Register March 2nd. The board held three hearings for the three rulemakings that you are hearing about today, and the deadline for receiving comments on all of those was April 1st. The board received several comments on the biomass rulemaking, and they were all supportive of adopting the rule. As I just mentioned, and I mentioned in the memorandum that I sent to you in your materials, DNR is planning to add a question and a data entry field to the forest practices application forms, all of them, that will specifically relate to biomass removal. So this will prompt applicants to provide the information on their proposed activities, and that will allow DNR and stakeholders to review the applications for any public resource issues that may be associated with their proposed biomass removal activities. So I now request that you adopt the rule and direct staff to file a CR 103 rulemaking order with the Code Advisor's Office. And if you do adopt the rule today, it'll become effective mid to late June.
All right, thank you, Gretchen. A motion would be appropriate now to get us rolling. Thank you.
Sure. I move that the Forest Practices Board adopt the rule proposal that amends WAC 2221610 by adding language to the definition of forest practice to make it clear that harvest of forest biomass is subject to the same resource protection measures as timber harvest in the Forest Practices Rules. I further move to direct staff to file a CR 103 rulemaking order with the Office of the Code Advisor.
Second to the motion.
I'll second.
Very good.
Doug?
Yep.
All right.
I think the motion is actually longer than the actual change.
All right, we have a motion properly supported to, what is it, a two-word or three-word change?
two.
Or forest biomass.
So that's three. So a minor change to existing rule language. Discussion on the motion before us. It's pretty simple. Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. Make that unanimous. Thank you very much. Thank you, Gretchen. Thank you, board. And now is an opportunity for public comment on the CEMER 2012 work plan and budget. And We have five individuals that have signed up to make comment. First is barely legible, but it looks like Stephen Burnett.
Shout out.
You were in a hurry, I can tell.
Chair, members of the board, this just be really quick. Before you is a non-consensus proposal that DNR will be presenting to you. This goes back to basically the issue, in my opinion, that we don't have a long-term funding plan for the adaptive management program. And we've had that on the table for over 3 years, both in the adaptive, in the strategic plan for adaptive management, in the clean water assurances milestones, and we repeated that ask as part of the RMAP five-year extension, and we still don't have one. So my concern is that as we continue to move forward on other endeavors, enforced practices, that we continue to strive to use a collaborative process to solve problems. And in this one case, there's been attempts, but we still haven't solved it. Until we do, I think we're going to struggle with this annually. And it presents a lot of uncertainty in whether we're going to be successful. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim Peters.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Peters with the Northwest Indian Fish Commission. The tribes support the CEMER priority list. However, we cannot support the budget. It takes $1 million out of the forest fish sport count that impacts tribal participation in the forest fish process and the implementation of the HCP. You have in front of you copies of letters that the Northwest Indian Fish Commission has sent to DNR in August 6, 2010, which is part of that letter was responding to a request from DNR that the tribes voluntarily decrease their participation to 20%. And then the letter to the governor, March 4th, dealing with her proposed budget of taking that $1 million away from us. So at this time, I want to give you a little history, since I think I'm the only one in this room that was a part of the whole process from day one. And the history of the adaptive management and tribal participation funds. At the beginning, the tribes, the timber industry, WFPA, state agencies, along with DNR, went back to the federal delegation and was asking for their help so that the state could have startup money for their adaptive management program. Along with that, the same group was in support that the tribes got participation funds to continue their participation in forest and fish and the proposed HCP at that time. Those funds were supposed to be for the life of the forest and fish process and the HCP. From that day, the state knew that they had a responsibility to fund the adaptive management program because the federal funds were only supposed to be a five-year program. And this was just startup money. Back then, there was some forest and fish policy caucuses that were interested in making sure that the state continued to work on a full-time funding plan. And about year three, we started asking questions to the state if, you know, what was going on, and, you know, they continue to say that we're working on it. Luckily, the federal government attached another 2 years of that funding for the state, and so we were able to extend that discussion. Unfortunately, at year six of that agreement, Norm Dix informed us that not only is the adaptive management funds weren't going to be funded anymore by the federal government, but the tribal participation funds were going to be dropped also, and told us that both tribal participation funds and the adaptive management program was the state's responsibility. So at that time, myself, in my role as the tribal chair for the Squaxin tribe, along with Billy Frank Jr. and Mike Graham of the Northwest Indian Fish Commission, met with the governor and the Department of Natural Resources to try to figure out how we were going to deal with these issues. After a number of meetings, the governor and the department and the WFPA came up with the Forests and Fish Support Account that would provide funds for tribal participation. It was our understanding at that time that it was a priority of funding from the Forest and Fish Assessment Account, and that any remaining money would be able to be used for other uses.
Excuse me, Jim, could you wrap up?
Yes, please? Yes, I'm almost done. And DNR has been administering it that way since then. Now, after years of the tribes and other caucuses within the Forest and Fish, the state still does not have a full-term plan for their adaptive management program. They're proposing to fund this off the back of the tribes. That this fund was specifically set up for our participation. And without the adequate funds, the tribes will not be able to participate in the forest and fish process, which will impact the implementation of the HCP. And this is one of the things that has been an issue within the policy group for many years, and the state still continues to ignore its obligations to fulfill that part of the HCP. It's wondering if the federal government would have seen that the state was not going to follow up on its obligation if the incidental take permit would have been even issued at the time that this was submitted. And I'm assuming the other landowners in this room are having HCPs have to fund their adaptive management program and things. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Kurt Veldhausen.
I wasn't planning on commenting on this topic.
Okay.
Thank you.
Miguel.
Thank you, Commissioner. Miguel Perez Gibson with the Conservation Caucus. I pretty much can echo what Jim Peters just told you in terms of where we were on this vote for the budget. I really think we really wanted to get in front of the board the issue that as we've been doing this budget now for the last few years, it keeps getting smaller and smaller, the CIMA project work list. And so there comes a point where we feel like we have to say, you know, is this really meeting the goals of the program, or dare I say the legal responsibilities? So let me say what the big picture here for us is, you know, when this ACP was signed way back when by the then Commissioner Sutherland and Reverend Gregoire, the fundamental point they pointed out was that adaptive management is the key to making this successful. Well, I don't think back then we had a clue that we were going to be in the kind of financial catastrophe the world's been in the last few years, and that we would see relatively small funding for a program like this start evaporating. But since the signing of the HCP, we've reduced foresters in the Department of Natural Resources doing forest practice compliance. We have less than we did when we signed it. We've reduced the small forest landowner office. When we talk about that compliance report you heard earlier, that's about the lack of technical assistance. That's gone. We've reduced the prep funding, FFF2P.
There's reductions in actual SEMA projects that was being put forward. We tabled the L1 projects to get going on these Clean Water Act ones, but we're falling behind on those milestones. And when we are talking about trying to get some fees, we're talking in the legislature about fees for rollbacks of legislation. So all those things considered, we felt like we needed to elevate this so that at least you hear from those participating in the policy committees, and yeah, of course the reduction in participation grants, I forgot to mention those, that this ACP we don't believe is meeting the requirements of funding that the state is obligated under to meet. Actually, I know offline those companies that do have ACPs and how they are funding them independent of this one. The money that they're putting in per acre that's being covered in the ACP is quite a bit more than what the state is doing for their 10 million acres. So while we do not support stopping these projects, that would be foolish. We want these SEMA projects to continue. At the same time, we don't want to give the impression that we think this is an adequate budget. We actually think it's a deficient budget, perhaps challengeable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question? Can I clarify, Miguel, in Jim Peters' testimony, he indicated that they supported the priorities but not the funding issues. Are you
yes.
in the Conservation Caucus yeah. in that same position?
Yeah, it's a dilemma because any way you squeeze this money or squeeze the program, you're not funding it fully. So either you have less projects and you have more people trying to supervise, or you have less people involved in the participation and more projects. So it's a no-win.
Yeah, I understand the yeah. dilemma there, but at least just to make sure
yes.
that I'm clear that you support the priorities, but
yes.
not the funding issue.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks, Miguel. Chris Mendoza.
Good afternoon, Commissioner, Board members. My name is Chris Mendoza with the Conservation Caucus. I'm also SEMA co-chair. I want to speak to a couple things concerning the work plan and the budget. First, I wanted to thank my fellow co-chair, Terry Jackson, who isn't here any longer. She's going to step down as SEMA co-chair this year. She filled a vital role in helping projects along. And also wanted to thank DNR, AMPA, Jim Hotbed as well. So I wanted to follow up a little bit, mainly just briefly, about why an adaptive management program of this nature is important. I think that if you worked on other HCPs, this one's unique, as everyone knows, because it's programmatic. It's linked to an FPA, unlike individual landowner HCPs, which don't involve huge committees to make decisions about what to do and what not. In that regard, this one has unique challenges. Also, this one, as most of you know, is more risk inherent. In other words, when the ACP or the Forest and Fish Report was agreed to prior to becoming an HCP, there was a large pile of projects stacked onto adaptive management that could not be agreed to by stakeholders. And a lot of those projects are related to rules that have potential risk to aquatic resources and have very little science underlying the rules. As opposed to more risk-averse HCPs at the state and federal level, where you have more trees left on the ground for greater protection in the absence of science underlying those rules. So that's what makes this HCP so unique, and that's also why the program is so robust, that a lot of those questions that were born out of Schedule L1, the remaining questions underlying a lot of these rules, the only way to get folks to agree to them was to ensure that there was a functional, robust adaptive management program. So having said that, I have to agree with Jim Peters and Miguel that as time goes by and you whittle down those projects, you are left with sort of the skeleton of what was originally on that list. And I think if you look at the SEMA work plan that we approved last year and go to the appendix, you'll see that there's a list of projects that we have, and there's also a list of projects that are delayed. In other words, they're not getting done. So I think that if you give if you devote adequate resources to the program, it will work. I mean, we've shown that through completing projects with fish model, the DFC validation study, type in the PIP study, and others. But keeping the machine kind of rolling takes some long-term strategic planning and additional funding. Thank you.
Thank you. So that completes the opportunity for public comment on the CMER 2012 work plan and budget. Moving on to the last item on today's agenda then is the work plan and budget itself. Darren? And I trust you're not going to go over these 200 pages? Or I hope.
You're in luck.
It's late in the day.
Again,
in a risky spot.
We'll reminisce here a little bit and stand in for Jim while he's taking care of some family affairs in the Midwest. Most of what I had to say has been said in one way, shape, or form. A couple of things I do want to point out is that the funding, while a challenge, the long-term funding, while a challenge, there is a different perspective on this that I have, that I used to have when I was in the role that Jim said, that I still have. And that's that when we were swimming in money, we still couldn't get projects done in a timely manner. There's only so much capacity in the system that's a volunteer system. And even when the participation grants came online and we were swimming in money, CMER only has so much capacity, policy only has so much capacity to put the projects up, get them out on the ground, get them through the system, through the review steps, and determine if action is needed. So back when I was doing this job, I estimated that we probably could only handle maybe a dozen projects at any one time anyway, even though we had enough money to put up two dozen. We just couldn't handle that many projects. It's too much to pay attention to. So while we do have a funding issue, a long-term funding issue, throwing money at it doesn't solve the problem. We need the people to help solve the problem. So that's my editorial comment before I start. So Jim wrote a lengthy and detailed memo about the situation that we're in, and I'm not going to read it all, but I am going to refer to the budget sheet, which is the cover sheet in your packet. And no, I'm not going to go through the entire CMER work plan, but I would like to point out that over the last couple of years in particular, CMER has done a huge amount of work to try to get this work plan to a place, to the place that it is today, which is a much more logical flow, clearly connects projects to L1. There's a table in the back that shows you all the different projects on the list and what types of topic areas they are focused on and how that connects to the original L1 schedule. They've done some work to better connect programs and projects to adaptive management, closing the loop, if you will speak. So I think they've done a lot of work on the work plan. It's nearly to a point where I think Board Member Fox requested a couple of years ago where we could bring a much shorter executive summary version of the work plan to the board on an annual basis rather than the 180-page entire work plan. Anyway, so I just want to compliment CMER on the hard work they've done over the last couple of years. So on the budget sheet, this is a summary of what's in the work plan. There's several ongoing projects. I believe there's 9 ongoing Tier 1 projects and a couple of new ones in Tier 1, as well as 2 or 3 new ones in Tier 2, but you'll hear about those if and when they are ready to move to Tier 1. So most of the focus is on ongoing projects. You can see the breakdown, the different projects under the different rule groups. We do have a couple of new ones there. One is simply an extension of one component of an existing project. That's the first yellow highlighted project on line 10. And that's another year of data collection, particularly on temperature and canopy regrowth after treatments. And then down towards the bottom, focus on a wetlands systematic literature review. That's the other new Tier 1 project. All the rest of those are ongoing projects that have been previously approved. Total budget for projects, $2.179 million. you flip the page over, you'll see the total CIRA budget there at 2.8. And while this is less than what you've seen in the past, it's pretty much the same. This is about the third year that we've had a budget of about 2.8 million. A few years back, when policy was wrestling with the Clean Water Act Assurance's priorities, they collectively agreed that the capacity of the program is about $3 to $3.5 million a year to be able to effectively spend money to put projects out on the ground and complete them. So while we're under that, it's not too far off. So that's the projects. I want to focus a little bit on the funding. You heard the testimony from some of the folks that were at the policy meeting that have concerns about the budget. The picture has changed since that policy meeting. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that the work is still going on over across the street that's going to affect the state budget. The funding sources what to describe as funds available on the bottom, towards the bottom of the second page on line 94 on the budget, shows our latest estimate of the funds available based on what we know today about the state budget. That's the Forest and Fish Support Account, as well as our operating budget, which helps to fund the adaptive management program. So as was mentioned, we're running shy on the federal. We will have that, I think we have that expended by now. We anticipate $600,000 in operating budget being available. We anticipate almost $2.3 million in Forest and Fish Support Account being available. We have the EPA grant that I think you heard about last spring that is funding the soft rock project, the new soft rock project, and then Ecology is contributing part of their pass-through money to that effort. So total funds available there at 3.18. Now, what this reflects is our current understanding of the budget, and that's the Senate version of the budget. You heard in testimony, the governor's proposed budget, as well as the House budget, had a reduction in participation grants to the tune of about $1.3 million. The Senate budget has a reduction to the tune of about $0.3 million. So that makes a big difference in what's available in the support account. We also found out that we have more carry forward or fund balance available in the support account than what was assumed at the policy meeting last month. So, given what we know about the budget today, we believe that we can fund this program and still have a fund balance at the end of the fiscal year. Now, obviously, that could change if the budget gets changed. But we think we've been conservative in our assumptions, and the picture is much better today than it was a month ago when policy was considering this budget. So while folks have concern about the budget, as we all do, particularly about the lack of a long-term source, we believe we do have enough to support the CIRA budget for fiscal 12 and possibly even fiscal 13. Yes?
Dan,
Before we get, do you have a question on the budget? Mm-hmm. So just before we get into, I just want to give a little fuller picture here of the budget. I think Darren has described the situation pretty accurately in the sense that two corners of the budget have not provided for have not provided full funding for the participation grants, and one corner has. There's another piece that I think is important for the board to understand, and that is it had been my hope to have a comprehensive audit and review of the adaptive management program. And I had a commitment from the state auditor to carry that audit out commencing this spring, because I felt for some period of time that there was an opportunity to really reform this program, as many programs have gone through reform, to make it run more economically and efficiently. Unfortunately, the state auditor decided not to go forward with his earlier commitment and has put me off for 2 years on his commitment to carry out an audit that would perhaps serve as a platform to reform the program. So there are some complications here. I had hoped to be able to find ways to perhaps run this program on a more timely, on a more efficient basis. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened. So in the absence of that, we're left with a difficult situation, as we can tell some of the participants are unhappy about the proposed reductions. But I wanted to make it clear that's not a choice for this board. That's a choice that's being made in the legislature about those grants. Sherry.
Yeah, that was kind of my question. There was the Environmental Caucus and the Small Landowner Caucus grants denied to or reduced considerably.
Yes.
How much?
50%.
Oh, okay.
And that has carried through in each version of the budget so far.
So I had a question based on an earlier comment that you made, and that you can't throw more money to get more done. But if participation grants go down, you don't have the volunteer staff to help get the work done. So I just wanted to point that out and say that I think that we do have a money problem in terms of getting stuff done. It's what it looks like to me, and I'm especially concerned about the. I'm concerned about the drop in participation grants for all caucuses, but I'm especially concerned about the potential for the tribes not to get the relatively large portion there.
Absolutely.
Seems to require their participation.
My comment was in reference to throwing money to put up more projects.
Right.
That we've been there before, not successful. Mm-hmm. So until we have more people to deal with that, putting more money towards that isn't necessarily going to solve our issue. But I agree that the participation grants are part of the program overall. And helping deal with those projects at the SAG level and sometimes at CMER as well.
Darren, one clarification, then a question. Did I understand you correctly to say that the Senate version of the budget has $1.3 million in forest fish support account, and then the House and Governor's versions have 0.3 million?
The House and Governor's version of the budget reduced participation grants by 1.3 million. The Senate version reduced it by 0.3.
Okay. I had the correct difference.
Yeah.
Just the
exactly.
Wrong understanding. Okay. Question is about the grant writer funding that's shown in here, and I don't remember if that's something new.
Yes, thank you. I should have pointed that out. And it's in Jim's memo, I believe. At the policy meeting, there was discussion, there was a motion made to dedicate a certain portion of staff time, all folks that get any funding from this budget, including scientists at the commission, project managers here at BNR, Jim himself, our contracts manager, to dedicate a certain portion of their time to looking for funding. The motion did not prevail, but the compromise was, why don't we stick a little bit of money in the budget should the opportunity present itself and we've got a project that's ready, we could hire someone to help us bird dog that and go find money to fund the project. And that, as I understand it, I wasn't personally at the policy meeting, so if this is a download from Jim, but as I understand it, that was the compromise that was reached at policy, and there was agreement to stick that into the budget.
Okay. Well, I support that. While grant funding in any time is a long shot or a crapshoot, I guess however you want to look at it, I think the only way that it can be successful is if somebody is dedicated to actually pursuing it and spending time, and it can't be the last thing that's on the pile on your desk or somebody else's, or it will never get done. So
absolutely.
I think this is a good way to hopefully find some additional funding.
I don't know that there was much discussion about operationalizing that idea and what that might entail, given the state of the budget right now and our inability to basically refill funded positions. But those details, kind of beside the point. The point was, if we have this opportunity, we should stick it in there. I guess I should also point out that there are several items here that aren't, and that's one of them, it is not money that's going to be spent no matter what. It's there. We might spend it if the opportunity arises and we can, but if not, it's going to remain in the budget.
Dave.
Maybe a policy question for us to discuss, but I'm hearing that there's general agreement about the priorities of the SCEMA program. The real concern is about the funding level for the participation grants, which we, to be really clear, aren't really effective today when they go to that decision to be made by the legislature. So that makes me feel more comfortable supporting these. But is there a mechanism or can we consider some expression of concern about the viability of the whole program, the capital management program, without those participation grants, both to carry out SEMA work and just to participate in the course of FIF, whether you're small or minority of the tribes? The concern that's been expressed is a real one. At some point, the whole thing falls apart because people aren't able to participate at it.
There's always the opportunity to work with the legislature and try and influence it. It's a little late in the process right now. I wouldn't say things have gone dark, but it's getting very difficult even for me to interact with any member of the legislature now. So, but you're, of course, the board is free to do whatever you think. Hopefully you've realized that before now, that issues, I know one member has, that the issues that are important to you, you're always, capable of going up there and letting the members know of your views, always.
Another question for Darren, to the question.
Yes.
On the front page, you have line 61, there's $400,000 for Fishery Commission staff. That's not participation, or is that?
Line 62?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's our scientist at the commission that leads several projects. So no, that is not a participation.
Other questions?
Just one comment, Darren. I really appreciate your hard work on this. Looking at this from a small businessman, if I had to float this budget, I'd be pretty nervous. I would really look really hard at the essential programs, and maybe you might really, the prioritization seems really critical in this to me, because I don't know. All I know, what I know is that I think money is going to be very hard to come by for the next few years, and you may end up short on some of these. So I would certainly be prepared to pull your horns in where you have to.
This is the third year we've made, the department has made a request for funding, long-term funding for the program. Someone, I think, in the testimony alluded to or suggested that the state had not followed through on that. So while we have not been successful for 3 years in a row since I've been here, we've been requesting long-term funding for the program.
Anna, did you have?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Dave for bringing up a suggestion that maybe as a board we can at least, rather than just having DNR request long-term fund or new funding for the program every year, I think power is in numbers, and certainly Fish and Wildlife would be willing to work with you on that in the future. And if we can get the whole board's support, not really sure, obviously not for this session, but in the coming session, I think that would be a lot more powerful statement. And maybe we need to have, I appreciated the Forest Ecosystem Collaborative, and I think there was one other meeting devoted strictly at the principal's level to talking about the long-term funding needs. And I know we didn't get a lot of brilliant ideas out of that, but maybe there's just the need for an ongoing effort outside of our four times a year board meetings to discuss this further.
Well, thank you for the reminder. I mean, there are two big funding issues that are before me as commissioner and also as board chair. One is FREP, and the second one is adaptive management. So there are some big issues that that it might be appropriate to engage the principals on. Yes.
So there have been some general comments about how if the
the funding trend continues downward, that that may endanger the permit itself, the HDP permit itself. And you know, we had a little discussion this morning about how Ecology is going to do some homework and come back to us in August and talk about clean water assurances. And I'm wondering if it's possible to have a more specific discussion, maybe in August or maybe prior to the next session, about where that threshold is. You know, so we see danger clouds looming out in the future, but at what point is a lack of funding for the adaptive management program, does that really put the permit in danger? And are there technical pieces of that that we know? Is this like, well, if this study isn't done by X time, or we're not able to, put certain protective measures in place or prove that they're necessary to lose the permit? Or is it more of a programmatic issue that if the whole program isn't supported over time, that that was part of the whole deal? So if it's not functioning the way it should, then at some point the services are going to come to us and say, you know, we really don't feel like we can support your permit anymore. I mean, having a more detailed discussion about where that danger zone is and how much time we have essentially to avoid it might be motivating for us to go to the legislature next year as a group, be more creative in finding funding. But I would like to get a better understanding of where that threshold or that zone is and what's involved.
Yeah, I guess my response would be it depends. I think we could go around the table and each caucus might have a little different answer to that question. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it's up to the feds to make that decision. And so far, we haven't had to eliminate projects. That's a good sign. Given the situation, we haven't had to eliminate projects. Matter of fact, we're adding new projects. So I think if you look around programs that are operating on the state budget, or at least have some portion of their funding from the state budget, that's pretty rare right now. So happy to have that conversation. I'm not sure it'll get to a clear conclusion.
I think what Darren just said is really important for this board to understand, that even in a era where the state's budget is being reduced on the order of $5 billion, in an era where major educational programs in public schools are being eliminated, in an era where major health programs to support different groups that are at high risk, in an era when there are cuts across the board in many state agencies, we've been able to maintain this project in a fairly intact fashion, which is commendable. That doesn't mean that we're going to be able to do so going forward. I agree, it's very difficult. But we're very fortunate to have been able to get as far as we have and look forward a year and see that we're going to be able to fund it. Now, agreed, there are some reductions that are affecting the participants. But quite frankly, this agency and the sister agencies that participate on this board and others have taken 20, 30, 40% reductions in many areas of their budget. So it's sort of the norm. It's not the exception. And I just want to commend staff for finding the wherewithal to keep at least the research component of the program strong. Just to add to what Darren said, it is going to be a matter of opinion on the part of the federal services about where that threshold is. And you could talk to the many different caucuses. All are going to have a different point of view about where that threshold is. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have the conversation. That doesn't mean we shouldn't redouble our efforts to find funding. But the hard reality is it's difficult, very difficult.
So if there are no more questions, despite the fact that there will,
Actually, this Good question, try. Maybe it's for Mr. Burnett. Stephen, could you explain to me line 36, what are we doing with the wetland systematic literature review, and how does that deal with L1 or L2, or is that just for CWA?
It's just a Google search.
67 grand in Google search?
I think there's a bit about this in Jim's memo as well, but Steve was at the meeting. He can fill in the details.
Okay.
So the history on the wetlands rule group is that initially there was a very high level of literature review done. It was the highest priority on forested wetlands done at the beginning of the Forest and Fish Adaptive Management Program. Then several years ago, on my insistence and working with my policy colleagues, we said, you know, we need to get on with wetlands and look at the issue of whether the mitigation sequence around roads affecting wetlands needs to, well, we need to do a CIMR project on that. And going out in the field with ecology's wetlands expert this last year, they came back to me and said I was all wet and said I was putting my eggs in the wrong basket and that we needed to do we really needed to take a better look at the forest and wetlands situation than we have in the past, and that that's where the priorities are. So this is as opposed to, you know, doing a really quick and dirty literature review, this is a annotated literature review that's actually going to provide some synthesis on what we do or do not know about recovery of forest and wetlands. And then that will lead us to, hopefully, a work plan on how to look at forest and wetlands. Because, as you know, under the forest practices rules, the only protection forest and wetlands get right now is the fact that landowners need to use low-impact equipment when they harvest them. And so there's the whole question about whether that has a long-term impact on those wetlands.
Isn't there also a seasonal restriction?
I'd have to look at the rule book to remember.
There is. Well, I have forest and wetlands, so.
So did that answer your question?
Yeah. I'm not sure it would hit a priority, but.
It is listed in, I think if you look back at Mark's assurances update to you in the staff report, it's listed as one of the CWA priorities.
So I guess the comment I would have for the whole board is policy and CMR is getting to the point now where we're taking a look at some of the directions we're going and figuring out whether we're going the right direction. And this is one of those areas we're doing that.
Okay. Just seems odd to start new projects. And the budget is what it is.
It's a paper project. I understand the concern.
It's cost 70
grand. It is a paper project. Right. The next part of it, which is in tier two, is the add-on should we come up with a on-the-ground type of project from that synthesis, then we would bring that back to you for consideration.
Gotcha.
Other questions?
So despite that we didn't have consensus on the budget, I think everybody was in agreement that these were the right projects. We need to continue doing the projects we have it on the ground today. We have a couple of new projects that are high priorities, and everybody was in support of that. So given that, Jim's recommendation and our knowledge of the budget as it stands today, Jim's recommendation was to approve the fiscal 12 CMR work plan and budget as presented. If the budget situation changes over the next month or two, and it looks like we won't be able to support this, then we would need to come back to you in August with a plan B.
And I would like to point out the Department of Ecology and their grant that they got from the Soft Rock. You should be thanked for that. That's a big chunk of change to put into the program.
Absolutely.
Kudos for that.
Well, I'll just say that Mark has done the lion's share of work on that. Put the grant application in. It's been working trying to keep EPA happy as
milestones on that project come and go, and he's working really hard to make that work.
Yeah, the more of that we can do, the more projects we will have.
There is an expectation, this side note, is there an expectation in the budget that new projects will be funded through grants? Fortunately, we have a little bit of fund balance to fund these small efforts on the new projects in fiscal 12, but any big new projects we would need to fund through grants.
So thank you for that presentation and the give and take with the board. For the board's consideration, there is a potential motion there on the screen. This is our last action item that we need to complete.
I'll move.
It's short.
Do it quick.
It's short. I move that the Forest Practices Board approve the 2012 CEMA work plan and budget as presented.
Second.
All right. Thank you. We have a motion properly supported to approve the work plan and budget as presented. Discussion on the motion.
I would just like to note for the record that while I appreciate how difficult it is to keep this funded at the level that it is this year, that I do have concerns about both participation grants and the future of the program. So I just wanted to note that for the record and implore all of us to work towards sustained increased funding in future years, and I will pledge to do it myself.
Okay. Anything else? All right, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, raise your hand, please. Okay. That's 11.
Sit on
your hand. Opposed? Okay, we have one opposition, and so that's it. I think it's 11 to 1. Motion carries. And I think that completes our agenda for today. Yes, Bridget?
Carolyn?
Oh, yes. I think, have all members of the board had a chance to sign the card to Carolyn? I think we have. I think we all know her absence, and we all know that she did resign from the board, and we all, I'm sure, miss her, and we'll look forward to a replacement from the governor's office as soon as possible. For my part, I wanted to thank the staff for working so hard to put this meeting together. As we all know, there was a tremendous amount of content in the meeting, a lot of rulemaking that went through, a tremendous amount of process that had to be followed, public meetings had to be conducted all across the state to make sure that we were doing these rules appropriately and transparently. I want to thank members of the public who were here today to make comment. That's always very valuable. And lastly, I'd like to thank the board for their serious engagement in these issues that are obviously important and worth everybody's time, but everybody makes a big effort to be here, and I greatly appreciate that. And with that, we are adjourned.